So I want you to think about this for a second. If you had to survive a sudden, terrifying encounter with the unknown, what do you pack?
Oh man, that is the question, isn't it?
Right. Like, do you bring a heavy iron horseshoe or do you bring like a brass magic wand? Because today in this deep dive, we are jumping back into the world of the Golden Hawks of Annieton.
Yes, the classic New England town where, things get very weird.
Super weird. And you already know the underlying lore of the Golden Hawks. We aren't doing the surface level world building today. We're looking specifically at the narrative architecture of their descent into the secret cave.
Which is just a masterclass in tension.
Absolutely. We're going to examine the exact moment when a harmless childhood game of make-believe violently collides with a terrifying, undeniable reality.
Because the transition between those two states, the imaginary and the real, is incredibly delicate,
Yeah.
right? So the mission for this deep dive is to explore how the narrative dismantles the mundane, everyday reality of Annieton.
Yeah, tearing away the safety net.
Exactly. We are diving into the mechanics of how the author forces these kids, and by extension, you, the listener, to confront this chilling possibility. The idea that the hidden magical world lurking in the shadows isn't just a metaphor, it is a physical, dangerous ecosystem.
Okay, let's unpack this.
Yeah.
Because to really understand the psychological shift that happens down in the cave, we really have to look at how these kids prepare for danger while they're still above ground.
Right, their whole gear up phase.
Yeah. The author gives us two completely contrasting approaches to confronting the supernatural here. Like, we start with 11-year-old Alice. She's in this antique shop, Kia's Restoration, looking for protective
Run
artifacts.
by Miss Black, yeah.
Right. And Alice's approach is entirely like spiritual and aesthetic.
I mean, she is essentially practicing sympathetic magic.
Oh, total.
She goes into the shop with her plush black unicorn, Lord Mill, and she literally holds him up to the glass display cases. She's doing this to help her locate things with magical resonance.
Which is such a great detail.
It really is. And she purchases a brass wand with a tarnished star on the end, which Mrs. Black actually marks down from $10 to $5.
A steal for a magic wand, honestly.
Right. But the crucial detail is the $5 crystal vial she buys. She gets it specifically to hold a single strand of her plush unicorn's crimson hair.
Yeah, Lord Mel's hair.
Exactly. She genuinely believes that carrying a piece of this creature she loves will act as a ward against the shadow monsters, the things she calls growlers.
Okay, wait, I have to challenge that interpretation of Alice a little bit.
Okay, go for it.
Is she actually seeking real, functional, talismanic protection, or is she just, heavily committed to the aesthetic of the game they're playing?
That's a fair question.
Because when you look at 13-year-old Agatha out at Danswick Stables, her approach feels fundamentally different. Agatha isn't buying crystal vials.
No,
Yeah.
definitely not.
She is scavenging the dirt paths for discarded iron horseshoes. She's loading heavy, rusty metal into a camping backpack because her mother's Irish folklore dictates that cold iron physically burns fairy creatures. Agatha is treating this like a tactical military operation.
Yeah, she brought the heavy artillery. It's like they're packing a dual-purpose survival kit. Agatha brings a crowbar and iron for physical threats, while Alice brings talismans for spiritual ones.
Right. What does it say about how we tackle unknown problems,
Well, I would argue that Alice's belief grants her items their power, at least psychologically. But if we connect this to the bigger picture, what makes Alice's preparation so vital to the narrative is how the adult world validates it.
Oh, the adults are completely complicit.
Yes. When Alice buys that wand, Mrs. Black doesn't patronize her at all. She physically demonstrates the elegant, proper wrist motion for swishing a magic wand.
I love that part.
Right. She treats the whole transaction with absolute gravity.
And we see that exact same adult validation with Agatha by the river. Like, while she's out hunting for iron, she runs into Richard, the retired guy who just got Harcourt Manor.
Yes, the town's legendary haunted house.
Exactly. And Agatha is looking at his black horse, Destra, trying to determine if it's the quote-unquote unicorn that Alice saw in the woods.
And that interaction grounds the mythology in such visceral, tactile reality.
It's so gritty.
Yeah, the author doesn't have them discuss ghosts or ancient prophecies. Agatha literally helps Richard gut a freshly caught trout on the riverbank.
Oh, and they use butcher paper so the scent doesn't attract raccoons.
Yes, and they talk about her father using peanut butter for fish bait. It is a profoundly mundane, sensory-rich scene.
It's just so practical. Agatha even casually warns Richard that little girls might mistake his horse for a unicorn. and she silently notes to herself that a real unicorn wouldn't wear iron shoes.
Always the tactician, Agatha.
Always. But the overarching point here is the safety net, right? Whether it's Mrs. Black teaching wand techniques or Richard conversing with his horse as if it's speaking directly to him, the town of Ainaton acts as a sandbox.
Yeah, the adults are enablers. They provide this padded environment where the kids can play at being adventurers without any actual real risk.
Right up until they go underground.
Exactly. That town-wide enablement is exactly what makes their descent into the cave so jarring. The town provided a safety net for their imagination, but the cave violently strips it away. The narrative shifts from preparation to execution as the Golden Hawks head to One Eyes Hill.
Yeah, they're heading to enter the secret cave, and they drop down into this massive dome-shaped underground cavern, and they are fully, fully in character at this point.
Oh yeah, they've got their whole party set up.
Right. Tom is Windrider the Mapmaker, Agatha is Redtail the Weapons Master, Simon is Sam the Minstrel, Alice is Angelique the Nurse, and Rebecca is Hawk.
A classic RPG party.
Total D&D vibes. Tom anchors a rope to a tree outside, acting like this mercenary squad leader, and they lower themselves into the pitch black.
And notice this shift in descriptive language here. Above ground, we had sunshine, dusty antique shops, riverbanks.
Nice and cozy.
But down here, the geography is unforgiving. The floor is slick with water erosion. Mm-hmm. There is a perfectly smooth, triangular-shaped pool in the center, and it's fed by three intersecting underground streams.
And it is entirely devoid of light outside their flashlight beams.
Utter darkness.
And the illusion of their harmless game shatters almost instantly. Like they're trying to cross one of these slick underground streams, and Simon the kid playing the minstrel, he loses his footing.
Oh, this scene is so stressful.
It really is. He slips on the wet rocks and falls directly into that dark, freezing pool. And the author makes a very pointed decision here. Simon cannot swim well.
No. He's instantly thrashing, going under.
Yeah.
It forces a total recalibration of the stakes.
Yeah, no more pretend.
Right. The narrative is telling the reader, you know, forget about imaginary dragons. The threat here is a very real, very mundane drowning.
A very physical threat.
The physical danger bypasses their fantasy personas entirely.
And Tom drops his gear and dives straight into the freezing water to secure Simon's arms. And Agatha, she doesn't pull out a wooden sword. She drops to her knees at the edge, holding her flashlight perfectly steady to guide them back through the dark.
She's so calm under pressure.
She is. They haul Simon onto the rocky shore, and he is just gasping and coughing. It really makes you wonder. I mean, think about it. How many times have you stepped into a situation assuming the guardrails were still on, only to realize you were suddenly in real physical danger?
Oh, it's a terrifying feeling. And the psychological fallout of that moment is beautifully represented by Simon's notepad.
Oh, man, the yellow notepad.
Yeah. He's sitting on the rocks, wringing out his shivering shirt, and he realizes his yellow notepad is completely ruined, just floating in the pool. The notepad he was using to write his imaginary minstrel rhymes is destroyed by the literal environment.
Hmm. The game of make-believe is officially dead.
Completely dead.
But the author doesn't just leave them in mundane danger, which is brilliant. While Tom and Simon are recovering, Alice takes a flashlight and uses a stick to trace a map of the cave's layout in the dirt.
Windrider might be the official map maker, but Alice is the one connecting the dots here.
Right. She draws the triangular pool and the intersecting streams, and she makes this terrifying realization. The underground layout perfectly matches a park above ground called the Siege des Anges.
The Siege of Angels, yeah.
Yeah. The underground pool aligns exactly with a flagpole on the surface. The debris piles align with surface statues. So what does this all mean? Is the cave designed as an architectural shadow of the town?
It is exactly that. It's a dark, inverted reflection. And establishing that geographical link is the bridge the author uses to introduce the actual supernatural elements.
We're real magic.
Because just as they comprehend that the cave is a mirror of their reality, they hear a distinct echoing caw from the northern section of the cave. The mundane danger of the water has passed, and now the true hidden ecosystem of Ainaton reveals itself.
So they go to investigate this noise, right? And they find this massive junk pile in the center of the northern cave. But it's not, like, natural debris washed in by the streams.
No, it's very specific.
It's a hoard of stolen childish items. Raggedy Ann dolls, broken fishing poles, pink pens. Agatha even spots a tiny pewter sword that is actually her own lost letter opener.
And think about the mechanics of the writing here. The author doesn't introduce the supernatural with a glowing treasure chest or an ancient glowing rune.
Right, no Excalibur here.
Exactly. The supernatural is introduced through a pile of literal garbage and lost socks. It forces the magical into the grimy reality of the everyday. And perched on top of this hoard of trash is a large black raven.
With a single eye that reflects red in the flashlight beam. Creepy.
Yeah, creepy.
And Tom, of course, tries to rationalize it immediately, because he's Tom. He pokes at the pile with a stick, assuming a human hermit left it there. And he looks at the bird and asks out loud, "Why am I talking to a bird?"
And the bird looks right back at him.
Yes, and replies in perfectly clear English, "Because you want answers."
God, what a line. What's fascinating here is how the narrative expands the mythology through dialogue. The bird introduces itself as Ryland of Avar.
Ryland.
And when Tom asks what this cavern is, Ryland calls it the Siege of Stone and Water.
Which confirms Alice's theory about the mirror geography.
Right. Siege of Angels above, Siege of Stone and Water below.
Mm-hmm.
But Ryland clarifies that he is merely a scavenger. The junk pile wasn't collected by him. It was stolen by creatures he calls the Drew.
Which Alice immediately recognizes as the Shadow Dogs, the growlers she was trying to protect herself against with the unicorn hair.
She knew it all along.
She did. The Drews are acting as these supernatural magpies, creating this massive underground lost and found, and Ryland is just picking through their leftovers. He proves this by literally swooping down and physically stealing Tom's silver pen and Alice's blue ribbon right out of their hands.
Just brazen theft. And this brings us to Tom's psychological reaction, which is perhaps the most compelling part of the scene.
Oh, for sure.
Tom is standing in a mirror cave, actively arguing with a one-eyed raven that speaks English and just named an underground monster faction. Yet Tom stubbornly refuses to believe in magic.
He just won't let it in.
He insists the bird must be a highly trained escaped pet. He even tries to negotiate a logical trade, offering the bird its choice of items if it returns his silver pen and answers questions without riddles.
See, I see Tom's reaction a little differently.
Oh, yeah. How so?
I don't think it's just stubbornness or rigid logic. I think it is a frantic, desperate cognitive life raft. I mean, Tom just almost watched his friend drown. His nervous system is already completely overloaded. Admitting that a talking bird and shadow monsters are real would just completely break his mind in that moment.
That makes a lot of sense, actually.
It's like an adult trying to troubleshoot a glitching computer by pretending it's just a loose power cord, completely ignoring the fact that there is a literal ghost in the machine typing messages on the screen.
That's a great analogy.
Tom is troubleshooting a ghost because the alternative is madness.
That is a brilliant way to frame it. He is preserving his sanity through pure denial.
Hmm.
Alice, on the other hand, she accepts the reality instantly.
Oh, yeah. She just rolls with it.
She totally bypasses Tom's aggressive negotiations, steps forward, and politely offers the bird a cookie from her purse.
A cookie?
And the bird simply says, "I would like a cookie, thank you," and accepts the trade. Alice's adaptable imagination allows her to navigate the bazaar without breaking.
It's amazing. But the narrative isn't done pushing Tom's denial to the breaking point. So Ryland flies off, vanishing into the shadows near the pool, and the kids move to investigate a second junk pile near a western rockfall. And this time, it isn't just a talking bird.
No. Agatha starts prodding the second pile with her heavy iron crowbar. And without warning, a creature bursts out of the rags.
Jump scare warning.
Seriously. And the description is jarring. It isn't a majestic fantasy beast. It is described as dog-like, but with a badger's tail. Again, it is grimy, feral, and deeply unsettling.
And Tom's immediate reaction is to fight. He loads his slingshot and fires into the dark, but he misses. But Agatha, she tracks the movement and catches the creature squarely in the beam of her heavy-duty flashlight.
The weapons master strikes.
Exactly. And the moment the pure, artificial light hits it, there is a sudden, audible pop, and the creature simply ceases to exist. It vanishes entirely.
It is the ultimate confrontation between the physical and the metaphysical, right? The creature cannot exist under the scrutiny of light. But the physical evidence it leaves behind is undeniable.
The nest.
Yes. They start digging through the monster's makeshift bed. Tom has to dig through a stash of horribly rotten fruit again, grounding the scene in sensory disgust, and he uncovers a golden crescent moon earring.
Nice find. But Agatha uncovers the true prize, a pristine, incredibly expensive-looking silver flute.
The flute?
Yeah. It is intricately engraved with a rose wrapped in thorns and the distinct, unmistakable shape of a key. So they are now holding literal, physical artifacts pulled from the nest of a vanishing monster.
And how do they process this? They fall back on empirical testing.
Of course they do.
Agatha takes her sounding line, ties one of her heavy iron horseshoes to the end of it as a weight, and drops it into that smooth triangular pool.
Tone the depths.
And the line unspools for a full 50 feet before it hits something solid. 50 feet straight down into the dark.
Yeah.
It reestablishes the horrifying scale of the environment they're in.
It's huge. And then Tom decides to test the flute. Now, the narrative has firmly established that Tom has absolutely no musical training. He doesn't know how to play an instrument.
Not a minstrel.
Right. But he puts the silver flute to his lips and blows. And instead of a harsh squawk or a breathy whistle, the flute produces an impossibly crystal clear, perfect musical note that rings through the silent 50-foot deep cavern.
It's pure magic.
It is. He tries it again, intentionally covering a hole near the engraved key, and it produces a different, equally perfect, resonant note.
The flute is undeniably magical. It completely defies the laws of acoustics and human skill. And yet, how does Tom process this absolute miracle?
Oh, this is the best part.
He immediately suggests that the flute must require sheet music to act as a password to a door.
Here's where it gets really interesting, because Tom's reaction is a profound critique of how modern adults process the miraculous. He is holding an item of pure magic, and his first instinct is to corporatize it.
Yes, systematize it.
He wants to systematize the miracle. He needs, quote unquote, sheet music because he needs a manual, a set of instructions,
yeah,
a logical input-output mechanism. He just cannot accept the wonder of it.
And Agatha is right there with him. She jokes briefly that it might be a magic wand in disguise, but then practically suggests they take it to a local music store at the strip mall to see if anyone lost it.
Strip mall.
I know. They process the terrifying and the miraculous by aggressively anchoring it to the mundane. They don't run screaming into the woods. They literally pack up their gear, walk back to the surface, and Agatha cooks kosher hot dogs on a portable camp stove for lunch.
The juxtaposition is almost hilarious, but it's just so deeply human. I mean, we have followed these kids from buying a $5 wand in a dusty antique shop to gutting a trout with the owner of a haunted banner.
Yep.
We watched them climb down a rope into a pitch black cavern, nearly drown in a 50-foot deep pool, negotiate with a talking one-eyed raven over a stolen ribbon, watch a feral badger dog pop out of existence, and uncover a musical key hidden in a pile of stolen socks. And they process it all by eating hot dogs.
Honestly, it's relatable. But if we connect this to the bigger picture, this is why the narrative architecture of Ananton is so compelling. It reflects how we all navigate a world that is increasingly overloaded with complex information, unexplained phenomena, and daily unpredictable crises.
For sure.
The Golden Hawks basically serve as a psychological blueprint for confronting the unknown.
Because you cannot survive purely on Tom's rigid, stubborn logic. If you do, the moment you encounter something that defies your worldview, your own metaphorical talking bird, your reality will fracture.
Exactly.
You will be stuck asking for the sheet music to a miracle.
But you also cannot survive purely on Alice's unchecked imagination either. Or you will freeze in terror at every shadow, convinced every bump in the night is a growler coming to get you.
Well, so true.
To truly navigate the dark, you have to synthesize the two approaches. You confront the unknown by balancing healthy, grounded physical preparedness with an open, highly adaptable mind.
You need Agatha's iron horseshoe in one hand to deal with the physical reality and Alice's magic wand in the other to process the unexplainable. You have to have both the iron and the wand.
I love that. And this raises an important question to leave you with. In the architecture of this story, the monsters don't hoard gold or jewels. The Drew steal forgotten everyday items, letter openers, pink pens, socks to build their nests in the dark.
Just normal stuff.
Right. So look around your own life. Think about the seemingly mundane items you have misplaced recently. The keys that vanished from the counter. The pen that rolled off your desk and disappeared. If you could somehow trace the path of those lost items into the dark, what hidden, unimaginable world might you find operating right beneath your feet?
Man, honestly, the next time I drop a pen and can't find it, I am absolutely going to assume a shadow dog dragged it into a mirror cave.
It's the only logical explanation.
Obviously. Well, thank you for joining us on this deep dive into the architecture of the unknown.
Yeah.
Keep your iron heavy, keep your wands ready, and we will see you next time.